University of California Television presents this podcast of Conversations with History, featuring Thomas P.M. Barnett discussing the Pentagon's new map, recorded in March 2005. UCTV's Conversations with History series is hosted by Harry Kreisler, director of UC Berkeley's Institute of International Studies. For more information about this and other UCTV programs, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Thomas P.M. Barnett, who is a strategic planner who has worked in national security affairs since the end of the Cold War and has operated his own consulting practice, New Rule Sets Project, since 1998. A New York Times bestselling author, Dr. Barnett is a forecaster of global conflict and an expert on military transformation and on issues relating to international security and economic globalization. He is the author of The Pentagon's New Map and a contributing editor to Esquire magazine. Dr. Barnett, welcome to Berkeley.
Thanks for having me.
Where were you born and raised?
I was born just south of Green Bay in a small town called Chilton. But my family moved several months after I was born, and I grew up in a small town of about 2,500, a rural community, a farming community, called Boscobel in the southwest corner of Wisconsin, basically where the Wisconsin River meets the Mississippi.
Mm-hmm. And looking back, how do you think your parents shaped your thinking about the world?
Well, it's kind of the classic situation of the model behavior. Both my parents were very avid readers. I grew up in a household where my dad watched documentaries and had the news on all the time and always had a newspaper or history book in his hand. And so I just naturally assumed that the way you interacted with the outside world and learned about it was to be a very avid consumer of news and history and mass media content.
And was your mother a teacher?
My parents met in law school. My dad finished his degree. My mom quit and finished up with a master's in political science. She went on to have 9 children. She later went into social work and then later went back and got her degree from law school 40 years after the fact and practiced law for many years.
And your father was a city attorney, which I guess affected your growing up years, I think I read in your book?
Yeah, he was sort of the local legal leviathan in terms of enforcing rules. We had kind of a relaxed community atmosphere to the extent where some guy might put a bunch of pigs in his backyard that the neighbors might not care for. And so my dad was always the guy who ended up having to enforce city ordinances, mm-hmm. which made him sometimes a bad guy in terms of the people that I ended up interacting with who were mad about this or that thing that he ended up enforcing. And in a small town, it's pretty impossible to escape that kind of personal connection.
So I guess you learned to defend the rule set, as we'll talk about later.
Yeah.
Where were you educated?
I went to a Catholic grade school, small one, about 100 kids, grades 1 through 8, and then went to a public high school. My older brothers went to a regional Jesuit school, a boarding school, as my dad and his father had, but that closed just before I got to age. And so I was the first Barnett male in my family to have to go to the local public high school, mm-hmm. which created a certain anticipation among the local boys as to how I would perform under such circumstances. I ended up becoming very focused on sports because that was the mode of gaining acceptability.
Mm-hmm. And what were your favorite sports?
I played football, basketball, cross country, and track. Mm-hmm. And I guess I liked basketball the most, but in many ways football was a great joy to me because my family had grown up, my mother's family, in the tradition of the Green Bay Packers. Her dad was the lawyer for the first 30 or 40 years of the Green Bay Packer organization. And on that basis, football and the Packers in particular were a very, very big focus in my family. So the ability to play football in high school was a very big deal. I was the one son out of seven, who did it.
Mm-hmm. And you went on, where did you do your undergraduate work and then your graduate work?
Well, I went from my public high school in Boscobel to the University of Wisconsin, which at that point, all you had to do was finish in the top half of your class in Wisconsin, and you were in at the University of Wisconsin. There I went from being kind of a bigger fish in a very small pond to joining a class of about 5,000, which was twice the size of my town. In fact, there were more kids in my dorm than my town, which was a shock. Having been raised pretty strictly as a Catholic boy, I went off and explored the wild side for about 4 years at Wisconsin, which was a perfect place to do it, mm-hmm. in the early 1980s. Became very interested in Marxism and studying the Soviet Union and China and Mao and Lenin and Marx, and really went kind of whole hog into kind of understanding that aspect of the dominant military conflict of the age. Learned Russian.
Mm-hmm. And then went on to do graduate work at Harvard in Russian studies.
I was very fortunate. I had and it's still to this day, it's a mystery to me. I was selected Phi Beta Kappa my junior year. Out of a class of 5,000, about three were selected the junior mm-hmm. year. And the big thing there, and this is back when kids only went to college for 4 years, back then, if you got your Phi Beta Kappa and could put it on your applications to grad school, mm-hmm. that was enormous. You could basically go where you wanted to because it was such a rare honor. And to this day, I still have no idea how that came about, who engineered that, or why, or what mm-hmm. made them think that I was the right person to do that. But it was a big, big turning point for me because at that point I said there were really two Soviet studies universities that I was interested in, Harvard and Yale. And I applied to both, got into both. But the Harvard offered the Red Sox and the Celtics and the Bruins, and Yale didn't offer anything. Even though they offered
only New Haven
and more money, they offered me more money, but I was more familiar with the people at Harvard in terms of Adam Ulam and Richard Pipes and these kinds of people. And I ended up being Adam Ulam's research assistant for 5 years, and that was a big personal growth period for me. Just having the opportunity to spend that much time with such a great thinker, and to achieve or to receive that sort of mentoring.
And what was the impact of that in the sense that here you were studying on under the greatest minds on a subject and a topic that would essentially disappear from the face of the earth, namely the Soviet Union?
Well, I always say it was with tremendous relief that the wall came down, because what I discovered in Soviet studies was that by the 1980s it had become so canonical.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't only have to be right, you had to be right on things for decades. And in that environment, I thought, well, how am I ever going to establish myself? All the big books have already been written.
Mm-hmm.
Where are you going to come up with a new theory or something that is, distinguishes you in a field that seems so set? In the book, I compare it to my fascination with the short television series Star Trek. I say being a Sovietologist was like being a Trekkie. Mm-hmm. There was only 79 episodes that you had to master to love Star Trek. And there was only about 79 years of the Soviet Union you had to master. And once you figured out all the big leaders and all the big periods and all the big debates, you were sort of done. Then where did you go with that?
Mm-hmm.
Except to drill down on very deep specifics. And what I discovered in pursuing the work was that I wasn't cut out to drill mm-hmm. down on nuances and details, that I was really more of what I call in the book a horizontal thinker. And so I didn't study the Soviet Union because I wanted to get really deep on the Soviet Union. I studied the Soviet Union because I wanted to kind of figure out how the world worked. And mm-hmm. that was the biggest other player other than us.
Mm-hmm.
So when they go away in 1989, I actually felt a huge sigh of relief, in part because I wrote my dissertation on East European Third World Relations, and I came right down literally to writing the last two chapters, The Future of Romanian Third World Security Relations, when they, on television, on CNN, dragged Ceausescu out, threw him against mm-hmm. a wall, and shot him,
mm-hmm.
which made that final chapter rather easy to write. There was going to be no future relations. And then, was it about a week later, Eric Honecker escaped and ran off to Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was, personally, in terms of the research, and then in terms of the field itself, I was sort of saved from the career path of being one of the leading lights in East European Third World Security Relations, mm-hmm. which, as you can imagine, isn't exactly a huge field. Now, what's interesting is how many people come out of that kind of focus, like a Condoleezza Rice,
mm-hmm.
like a Francis Fukuyama, whose book on that subject was one of the leading sources in my own dissertation,
mm-hmm.
how so many people came out of that that really narrow field of trying to understand the global security environment in terms of the big players, and later went on to become kind of, you know, big thinkers on globalization, mm-hmm. that it was a natural progression, mm-hmm. or you could say we had no choice.
Yeah, but you're also suggesting that you were forced not to be a vertical digger, as
right.
you were just saying,
right?
Because there was nothing to dig anymore, but the training had positioned you to look at the new world. So what led in your particular case you into becoming a strategic thinker, a strategist? How did that happen?
Well, I'd kind of grown up on the Second World War because I was born just 17 years after the end of the Second World War. So in that kind of recycling of history that occurs on a 20-year basis, the nostalgia factor for the 40s was fairly high in the 60s. And it was just the sheer volume of those kinds of television shows and books and movies mm-hmm. that got me very interested in the Second World War. And as soon as you got interested in the Second World War, it was all about explaining and understanding how the current security environment had come about. And once you got that understanding, mm-hmm. then it was sort of, well, how does that work? And about the time I came of age is when Nixon went to China. Mm-hmm. And that was a very, very big thing for me because it was just, you know, spectacular and fascinating. And the notion of having that kind of impact and engaging in that kind of activity became kind of a personal obsession. I had an older brother, the firstborn in my family, who learned Japanese and went into the international financial world. And so I took his pathway and said, I'm going to do the same thing, but I'm going to do it for international security. So learned Russian literature, and then went to Harvard. And then I was talked into staying for a PhD. I was just about going to leave with a master's. I was going to do the classic thing of going down to Washington trying to earn my PhD on the side, because mm-hmm. my wife was rather impatient with the whole young genius living on $5,000 scholarship kind of thing. Because I was working as a superintendent for rent in an apartment complex and fixing a lot of toilets, and it just wasn't the glamour trajectory that either she or I had imagined. But I was cautioned by a former British MP, a guy named Rod McFarquhar, a tremendous China scholar, mm-hmm. who at the time had just become the chairman of the Department of Government at Harvard. And he said, get your union card, get it now. If you go down to Washington, you start working. He says, I've lost so many students that way. Mm-hmm. You're going to have a baby. You're going to have two babies. Your wife's going to want to stay home, or she's going to want to work, or either way, but it's going to be more complex than you realize. You're in your mid-20s now. Just cram your way through whatever you need to do to get the topic approved, and then go as whole hog as you can on it in 1 or 2 years and get it written. And don't dawdle with it. He said, don't try to write the theory of everything. Focus on just creating a nice brick and putting it in the wall. Get your union card and move on. And one of the big pieces of advice that went with that was Adam Ulam telling me, I did my dissertation on English socialism and then went on to a career in Sovietology. Mm-hmm. He said, do not think that what you do as a dissertation topic is going to determine your career, which is a fallacy a lot of graduate students fall into. Mm-hmm. They want to make it their entire life. I wrote that dissertation in about 12 months after researching it for a year, after learning two new languages to get it down, after taking just a year to pass my comps, so I got it in 4 years, which is about as fast as you can go, and I'm really glad I did. Mm-hmm. And then I turned it into a book with Prager and sold the requisite 300 copies to research libraries around the world, and then I put that chapter behind me and said, what can I really do now that I have this accreditation? And that's when I went to Washington.
And so what does a strategic planner, thinker, analyst do?
Well, you know, I spent a lot of time in the book trying to describe my career path, in part because I would have died or killed to have a book that actually explained what it was like to work in my field. I had the most naive assumptions about going to Washington and becoming somehow a diplomatic type person in the State Department or CIA, or I had a vague understanding of defense, but I thought that was pretty much a military-dominated thing, and I had absolutely no understanding that there was this huge research complex that had been built up around the military over the Cold War. There was this tremendous private sector research and operations research industry If I'd had any knowledge of that, I think I would have taken some different courses, to be honest. I probably would have gotten into statistics more, would have taken more international economics. I probably would have taken more military courses, and I would have very seriously considered a ROTC a situation, just to get a little taste of that kind of experience. But when I got down there and discovered what it was first and foremost, as anything is in a private sector, it's a business. It's not just, what do I want to research? What might it do? It is, you've got clients. Clients have problems. Clients want solutions, and they will pay a certain amount to have that solution enunciated to them. And so since I was somebody who had gone through my dissertation with a real discipline in terms of time, I adapted fairly well to it, and yet it was still a huge learning curve. I mean, it wasn't just the notion of doing things on a budget and on a timeline, but it was the notion that the answers couldn't just be nifty or theoretical or clever or even right. They had to be practicable. They had to be actionable. If they weren't actionable to decision makers, then you were wasting their time, and they would stop you 5 minutes into the brief, which was another thing which really set in motion my career, this new form of communication. Yes, you did the written report, just like a research paper, but the real method and mode of transmission of ideas inside the Pentagon was to walk into the office of the sponsor, often a flag rank officer, a general or an admiral, and deliver what at that point was still on acetate view graphs, we called them, which you put on an overhead, but quickly segued with the advent of the PCs and the Macintoshes to PowerPoint and the electronic display. And what I realized was that I had a real facility for kind of marrying up images and conceptualizing very complex things that decision makers needed to have conceptualized so they could simply get the lingo down and get the sense of the universe down. With the rise of the information technology across the military in the 90s, just helping people understand the concept of an internet, an extranet, an intranet, and marrying these up with political change concepts or economic concepts as to how the global economy worked, and to be able to display that visually and explain it over and over again to large audiences and even to very small audiences was a particular niche that I could carve for myself that dovetailed nicely with the desire to be not just a horizontal thinker, but a strategist.
You've talked about this again and again, which is horizontal thinking. I want you to touch on that a minute. It's getting out of that narrow box and looking at things broadly and in your case globally. And then the other note that I made in reading your book is really interdisciplinary thinking, that you're bringing things together in a new, a different way. And in some ways, I mean, I'm grossly simplifying here, but one of your achievements has been to bring globalization to the Pentagon's way of thinking.
Right.
Is that fair?
That's a very good description. In fact, that's how I've often described myself.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard to understand, and it was hard for me to understand, being up at Harvard, where we were taught game theory and all these kind of neat theoretical constructs to kind of describe in the billiard ball fashion how things kind of bumped up against one another. Whereas when you get down to Washington, you realize it's a hugely complex, ever-evolving debate with a lot of different positions, so that how you get ahead in terms of these intellectual conflicts and these policy debates is to typically become a what I call a drill-down expert. You are the guy who knows everything about this one weapon system, or this one tank.
Or the Romanian military.
Or Social Security, or pension plans. And your primary function in amassing all that information is your ability to be wielded like a knife in a fight against opposing ideas. And your primary function then is to argue against comprehensive packages by pointing out the flaws. So I found that kind of thinking, one, very constraining, and two, very negative. I spent all my time not creating ideas or packages or visions, but destroying other people's work. And that was very much in the mode of the inter-service rivalries. I mean, I spent a lot of time dismembering the Marine explanation for the world and the Air Force explanation, the Army explanation. And there was just kind of an emptiness and a sense of negativity associated with that that kind of came to a crux personally for me, where I decided I simply didn't want to be about that anymore, and I wanted to be about something else.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to ask you about creativity in this field and relate it to your own account of how you came to your new map for the Pentagon. And it's partly about doing empirical work, looking mm-hmm. at a map, drawing a map of where we were intervening and how we were intervening in the 90s on the one hand. But on the other hand, being positioned to respond to the events of 9/11. That was a burst of creativity, those things coming together. Talk a little about that.
Well, there were sort of three big preparatory periods leading up to 9/11. The first one was about a three-year effort I put in at the U.S. Agency for International Development, where I was looking at the Third World, I was looking at development economics, and I was looking at trying to reconceptualize what it meant to economically develop a country that wasn't succeeding. So that was sort of one piece of how the world works or doesn't work. I'd already had the military and the security kind of background. After that, I was so intrigued by that kind of notion and trying to figure out the mixing of the military and I call it the market to figure out why the employment of U.S. military power around the world actually had either beneficial or negative consequences in terms of economic development of countries, that I said I really had to broaden the research base that I was pursuing. About that time, I had the opportunity to leave where I was working at a think tank in Washington, the Center for Naval Analyses, where I worked primarily for the Navy, so I had a certain reputation with the Navy, and go to the Naval War College. Now, the big draw there was that they had an ongoing research partnership with a broker-dealer of great renown in the field, but not well-known at that point to the wider public, Cantor Fitzgerald, which is the largest broker of sovereign debt in the world. They do about $70 trillion worth of business a year, which is twice the global GDP, so we're talking huge sums of money. They had come to the War College in the mid-1990s and said, we'd like to run some kind of economic-oriented war games with you where we bring together Wall Street people and national security people and talk about how the world works in terms of economics and security. Well, they had done some of these in the mid-1990s. The process had sort of lapsed by the time I'd gotten there. And one of the first things I was asked to do, the first project I was asked to pursue at the Naval War College, was to look at the year 2000 problem and to treat that as an opportunity to kind of understand how the rise of the global economy in the information age was kind of mixing economics and security in ways that we weren't well understanding. It was a perfect opportunity for me because it really allowed me to branch out into a range of subject matters that were very non-traditional for a naval analyst. Well, Cantor Fitzgerald joined that research effort. After we did all the work on Y2K, that became this project that they had always dreamed of doing, this kind of high-end wargaming series where we would look at the future of globalization and ask, in effect, what could be threatening to globalization as a historical process. And that became what we called the New Rule Sets Project, which becomes later in my private sector endeavors the name of the consultancy I pursued because I still so like that moniker and the notion of focusing on what are the new rules. And what we did in that workshop series is we brought together Wall Street CEOs, subject matter experts from academia and think tanks, and national security heavyweights from the White House and from the Pentagon, and we looked at what it meant to integrate developing Asia in this ever-expanding global economy and how that would impact our definitions of the future of the world. And we were having conversations about rising China and rising India about 5 years before anybody else was talking these subjects. Why? It wasn't because the military was talking about them. Mm-hmm. It was because Wall Street was talking about them and could see them happening. So between the USAID experience, Agency for International Development, and those kinds of things with the Third World, the sense of understanding of the global economy through the Y2K project, and then this look at the future of globalization with Cantor Fitzgerald, I'd really kind of put together on top of my previous training in national security and my ongoing work in it, a unique package and perspective that was almost completely useless in terms of an audience. And it's one of the things you learn in this kind of business. You can have an answer, you can have a very good answer. But if you don't have a client who wants that answer inside the U.S. government and needs that answer and can act on that answer, and that answer has to be actionable, then you really don't have anything other than a neat idea. Mm-hmm. But if you have that package, then you can really, you know, tilt some policy, you know, perhaps even tilt some history if you're the right person with the right idea and the right connectivity at the right time. So 9/11 occurs, the research project with Cantor Fitzgerald, which we had pursued in these workshops atop the World Trade Center, you know, disappears instantly. And Cantor loses 658 individuals on that day. Although thankfully the two great mentors from the firm who I interacted with were both, for accidental reasons, just out of the building that instant. But I was without a project, without any sense of where to go. I had this feeling that what we were looking at in this project was really something important, but I didn't seem to know where to go with the answers or even the questions that were popping into my head after 9/11. Well, the president of the War College was a very famous vice admiral named Art Sabrowski, very much associated with the concept of military transformation. He's asked by Secretary Rumsfeld to be his director of this new Office of Force Transformation almost immediately after 9/11. He calls me about 3 weeks after the event and says, come work for me. I say, what are you looking for? He says, I'm looking for a national grand strategy for the United States. Everybody here is busy fighting this global war on terrorism and whatnot. I need to hire kind of you to come in and help me just think about this, because as I transform this force and advocate certain policies in terms of future acquisitions and reform of the military, I have to have an operating theory about how the world works and what the employment of military power is going to be all about. So it was just this, you know, amazing opportunity falling in my lap. I was going to be able to define this thing very freely on my own with interactions with others. On the basis of this tremendous trajectory, which up until that point in this opportunity made little sense and provided little actionable ideas. But I was going to be able to do it for a guy who was going to be able to deliver that message directly to the Secretary of Defense, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and the White House. And so that was just an amazing stroke of luck.
So after 9/11, the White House and the Pentagon was asking the question and needed the action plan for which potentially and probably much so you had the answer to.
Well, that's a little too generous in terms of its 2020 hindsight.
Okay. Well,
because there was a huge scramble.
Okay.
To adjust to, you know, what had just happened with 9/11, and all of a sudden we're in Afghanistan, mm-hmm. and then the buildup towards Iraq. They weren't asking the question. They had promulgated an answer called the Global War on Terrorism. But what they were running into was that this was such a narrow definition that mm-hmm. inside the military, inside the national security establishment, inside the U.S. electorate, I would argue, and with our allies all over the world, there was the question not do you know where you're going to, but where are you going? Mm-hmm. Can you describe it for us? Can you tell us how we can help, how it's good for us, how it's good for the world, how this all comes together? What's a finishing line? How do you measure progress? And those answers weren't put out by the Bush administration in defense of you know, their brutal schedule at that point. They were scrambling to deal with a lot of things. What happened was the discussions revolved around those questions, and the package I put together in terms of this brief, which became quite famous in the Pentagon, I delivered it several hundred times and then started delivering it to the private sector and to foreign governments, was that people would say, you know what? This guy, this one guy working in this one office seems to have an answer that sort of puts it all together. And they like it in the secretary's office. They use him to brief new officials. They use him to brief foreign governments. Is it official? No. But it does kind of answer a lot of your questions. So it filled a void that was there. Were they asking for it? Not exactly. Did they like it when they were presented this package? Yeah, because everything they were doing fit within it. Mm-hmm. And it gave them a vernacular and a lexicon and a way of explaining, you know, everything else.
The next question is an unfair one because for somebody who is known throughout Washington, and I guess the world, is having this masterful PowerPoint presentation.
Yes.
But since we do not have the time, what is the short version, the very short version of the way you came to view the world?
Well, it really all started with a simple mapping of of U.S. military crisis responses since the end of the Cold War. And once you mapped it on the world, you noticed that there were geographic concentrations. And being a kind of simplistic guy, and maybe it was my soft scientist, political science background, I said, well, what if I just drew a line around 95% of them? And what do I got for a shape first? And what does that shape tell me? What are the unifying characteristics of these regions? And what you end up drawing is a shape that stretches from the Caribbean Rim, the Andean portion of South America, virtually all of Africa, the Balkans, the Caucasus, Central Asia, the Middle East, and much of Southeast Asia. And the argument that I came to, and it was one of those things where you have to make a leap of logic if you're going to start the conversation. If you wait for the perfect answer, you're never going to get it. So you throw out kind of an overarching concept and let the data come to you. Let people say, you know what, you're right. And I got this thing that proves that, or I got this database that backs that up. And so what I threw out on the table was the notion that these regions, collectively, are the least connected to the global economy. That what we were looking at was the limits of the spread of globalization. That's the shape we were looking at. And that's why, if you bundled up the almost 150 crisis responses, including some wars that we fought since the end of the Cold War, that's what the organizing principle was. It's where globalization hadn't extended itself, where the connectivity of the global economy hadn't generated stability and development and growth and peace and clear rule sets and democracies and whatnot. That this is where the disconnected people were, and on that basis, no surprise, that's where the terrorists came from. And so that's where the vision really starts.
And what is really new and revolutionary here is not that globalization hadn't been discussed in other intellectual discourses, but rather that this gave you and us, the United States, a definition, a new definition of what the threat is, disconnectedness.
And you know, you can parody that and say, well, maybe this is the first war fought against an adjective or something like that. But what it really is getting at is you know, globalization's not a binary outcome. Despite its name, it's not everywhere. And if you look back over history, the answer is the spread of the global economy has been an ongoing affair for decades and decades, and all along the way it has met resistance in terms of fascism, in terms of socialism and communism, and it's meeting it now in terms of this kind of religious totalitarianism represented by the global Salafi jihadist movement. So you start to see an arc of history, and you start to say, well, this is just the latest version. And in that way, you connect the military back up to the market, to global economics, because in the Cold War, they had become so distant from our definitions of how the world worked. It was just this, you know, this tremendous Leviathan force that prevented global nuclear Armageddon. What was it good for? It was good for preventing global nuclear Armageddon. How did that connect to the rest of the world? It didn't, and we were grateful for that. But now that that's kind of all gone, and you find yourself using military power at unprecedented rates across the 90s, you needed a theory to come along and say, well, this is how I connect you to the outside world. This is why military force needs to be contextualized within a larger understanding of how the world works. And that was, the reception I got from the military was one of, you know, great excitement and gratitude, because it sort of said to them, hey, this puts me back in the frame of knowing what my career is about. And so the biggest acceptance has been within the military, to my surprise.
Mm-hmm. And what you're actually doing here is you're taking our ability to export security in a way, and tying it to the broader context of the flow of people, the flow of money, and the flow of energy resources.
Right. I mean, it's a rather reductionist model that I offer in the book. But what I say is that if globalization is going to continue to expand, certain resources need to flow from areas of surplus to areas or regions of deficit. And obviously, most of the energy now in the system is in that non-integrating gap. And most of the energy use is inside the core. So that flow has to occur. The core as a whole is aging demographically. The gap as a whole is fertile.
And the core are the great powers, the traditional great powers, the developed societies.
Yeah, it's the West plus the East, in effect. And some key pillars rising from what used to be called the Third World, like Argentina, Brazil, Chile, South Africa, some of these countries.
And the gap is the area that globalization has not reached.
Or has reached in a very narrow fashion. Mm-hmm. I mean, if all you do is export oil and mm-hmm. have very little interaction with the outside world, that's not connection. Mm-hmm. So not only does energy have to come out of that gap to the core, people have to come out of that gap to the core because of the aging demographics throughout the core. So those two flows have to happen. For that to occur, a certain amount of security has to be, in effect, exported or given from the core to the gap, these regions that still suffer basically all the wars and the civil wars and the genocide and the ethnic cleansing since the end of the Cold War. We have to make that effort if we want those flows to occur and be stable. And we also have to see a continuing flow of foreign direct investment because that's what extends globalization. It's not aid, although remittances for people going to advanced economies and sending their earnings back to poor economies is huge. The real development comes when the major investors of the major economies decide to come into a country and create industry. That's what really moves things along. That's what's developed Asia in the last 20 years. And so there's a sense of an argument I offer in the book and in the brief that says, here are these four flows, and they have to be kept in some sort of balance. Not too much security, not too little. Not too much energy, not too little. Not too much movement of people, not too little. Not, you know, there's always got to be enough flow of money.
Now, not everybody in the Pentagon liked your briefing, because implicit in what you're saying is the old way of viewing the threat is no longer the case. So
right.
During the Cold War, Kissinger and company were concerned about the rising, emerging power of the Soviet Union
right.
and the threat they posed.
Right.
But what you're saying is, no, that's not the problem now. Let's not worry about China. Explain that.
Well, the argument I make is that it's taken us a long time to understand this, and it really defined our sense of kind of understanding across the Cold War, was that nuclear weapons and coming into being and their capacity to destroy the entire planet basically ends war among great powers. There has been no war between two great powers since the Second World War and the invention of nukes. And it took us a long time to even come to that understanding vis-a-vis the Soviets in the concept of mutual assured destruction, that nukes were for having, not for using. So if you add that on to the kind of arguments that have been around for a long time, stretching all the way back to the earliest forms and periods of globalization around the beginning of the 20th century, then you're talking about, yes, there is such growing economic connectivity between these great economies that if you add nukes on top of that, it basically rules out the concept of zero-sum war, meaning I can attack you and I can actually benefit from that and you will lose. So once you get past that kind of understanding, you get past the competition and the bipolar standoff with the Soviets, then you start looking around the world and you start saying, hey, if you're developing, if you're synchronizing progressively your internal rule sets, your political, economic, legal, social, with the emerging global rule sets that define the global economy and its spread, then you should be an ally naturally and not naturally an opponent. So it puts China, I think, in one side of the ledger as opposed to the other. The historical argument is China's rise at the beginning of the 21st century, very much like America's rise at the beginning of the 20th century, or is it like Germany's rise mm-hmm. at the beginning of the 20th century? And we're sort of the UK or the Britain of our era, and so the real choice for America is, do we look at China as a rising United States, somebody we can bring into the larger community and mentor and integrate with militarily over time, or are they a threat that we're ultimately going to have to deal with? And my argument is it all depends on how much China increases the connectivity between its public and the outside world, and to the extent that it does so, it's going to create naturally a pluralistic sort of momentum in their political system, and I see that connectivity expanding just hugely across the last 5 years, especially, and all signs are it's going to increase in the future. So much so that I argue that you can hedge against the possibility of China becoming a threat with a modicum of your force, and on that basis free up the rest of the resources to deal with the real security issues of our age, which are going to be global terrorism, failed states, and, you know, shrinking this gap that I described.
Now the security problems that arise in the gap, by your understanding, require two different kinds of military.
Right.
Explain that to us, and how does it tell us what we should prepare for the future.
Well, and it segues neatly from the previous answer in the sense that, I mean, you were asking about the big one, so to speak,
yeah.
Our focus on a big competitive threat, a big country like us who would field a big military, high technology. That was the model we carried through the Cold War. It was planning for World War III against the Soviets. What was our tendency coming out of the Cold War? To look for a replacement for the Soviet Union. And over time, as China develops, well, that becomes the natural default position. Are they aggressive or antithetical to us in any manner? Well, it didn't matter to the Pentagon. It was the best going concern to plan for big, big war in the future, which is all about, you know, buying weapon systems and giant platforms. So the tendency of the Pentagon to keep on that momentum path made it hard for them as we engaged in more nation building, peacekeeping, crisis response, that kind of stuff, humanitarian assistance. Across the 1990s, it was a huge burgeoning portfolio, basically a fourfold increase. It was hard for them to say, I want to embrace this, because to embrace this new set of activities was to discard the focus on the big one, and it was to possibly diminish the fixation on China. What I argue is, you need, in effect, always to have that warfighting capacity. I don't want to get rid of that military. It is the hedge against the near-peer competitor if China were ever to move in that direction.
You call that the Leviathan.
Call that the Leviathan, you know, evoking Thomas Hobbes' famous book on that score. And, you know, it really is a Leviathan. We came out of the Cold War experience with a lot of predictions from international experts that there was going to be a natural balancing, that a near-peer would rise militarily. And what has happened is nothing of the sort. That the world has, in effect, accepted our Leviathan status. And we're to the point now where nobody can wage war unless we say so, and nobody can stop a war until we say so. But as we learn, using that Leviathan force across the 90s, and especially in Iraq with this most recent invasion, is that to win the war is one thing, but if you don't follow to win the peace, you haven't really achieved anything. In fact, you're probably just going to end up going back in another 5 to 10 years. And so the experience of Iraq allows me, the occupation, not the war, to bring out into the open and to make a calling card of the book this argument that you need to get back to what we were before. Two different forces, one for war, one for peace. We had two different militaries throughout the vast bulk of our history. We had the Department of War and the Department of everything else called the Department of Navy. And I think we're heading back to that bifurcation. I think Iraq has proven it. And so one of the calling card concepts from the book, which is really gotten me a lot of international travel and gotten me most of the acclaim from the book, is this notion that we are going to have both a Leviathan force for the war and what I dub the system administrator or sysadmin for the peace.
Mm-hmm. Now, Iraq seems to be a case in which we haven't got the show on the road with regard to both parts of these military missions.
Yeah, it's a real tipping point.
Yeah, and I guess what I would assume that you would feel that we will learn from that experience. But what I'm curious about is the legitimation of this bifurcation, both domestically in the United States and internationally. And what I have in mind here, you quote Rumsfeld as saying at one point, well, you fight the war with the arm, with the military you have. And I want to paraphrase that and say to you, well, you fight the war with the domestic politics you have. And I guess what I'm leading to is, I guess, we really need a lot of public education.
Sure.
On understanding that this is a long-term mission.
Right.
It is a global mission that we have to undertake because we may be the only one who can do it. And there's a lot of work there. Isn't that in explaining that reality to our democratic citizens?
Well, I mean, first it comes to the simple notion of the map and making the argument about the connection between the military and the market, or between, in effect, the bodyguard role that the U.S. military has been undertaking for 15 years now with the process of globalization's progressive advance around the planet.
So we've been doing it.
We've been doing it for quite some time,
yeah.
And it's not really been understood by the American mm-hmm. public, but we've been doing it massively for the last 15 years, and we've had a lot of trouble adjusting to that. And the tipping point comes with Iraq because, as Rumsfeld said in that response to the question from the reservist about hillbilly armor in Iraq, he said, you go to war with the army that you have, not the army that you want. But the better answer is, you go to war with the army you've been wanting.
Mm-hmm.
okay, and buying for the last 15 years. And the Army has not wanted to buy or build or field that nation-building, peacekeeping, sysadmin-like force. And so Iraq's a real tipping point where the Army finally has to admit, hey, we've done this a lot since the end of the Cold War, about once every 2 years. This is the fourth Muslim country we're doing nation-building in. We can't deny anymore that this is the pattern. We can't deny that we need to make this shift. And so that process of building the sysadmin force is already well underway. How we explain it to the American public is to make the argument first again about that connection between the military and the market and the spread of globalization, but you have to connect it to the global war on terrorism and say, hey, if you want to win that, this is how you win it over time. You make globalization truly global. You end the disconnectedness that generates the conflicts and the authoritarian regimes and the anger and the diminished expectations that get you terrorists. And then you have to make that argument about the use of the Leviathan force in connection with the sysadmin force. Don't plan for the war unless you plan to win the peace, which was a great line Kerry used in the election campaign. And then you have to extend that argument to your allies and the rest of what I describe as the core and say, in effect, hey, are we interested in expanding the global economy? Are we all dependent upon it? Is it a good thing to reduce this area of disconnectedness and all the security issues we collectively face there? Do we understand our shared vulnerability? Are you interested in putting together a package that would contextualize the use of this force, that would bind us together in a larger effort, make that sysadmin force very internationalized, very coalition-focused, where the U.S. component is maybe 10, 15%, like it was in the Balkans? Are you interested in making that all happen? Do we have the resources? Can we share them? I think the answer is when you pull that set of resources, when you make explicit or transparent what you're trying to do, and you make clear to your potential core allies, hey, we're not in this to rip you off. This is not a zero-sum game. We all want these bad actors to disappear. We'll all make money and become more successful and develop further, and we'll grow the global economy, and it'll be a more just world. Are you interested in contributing to that? I think the answer is yes, but it requires us to think about war within what I call the everything else. Not just judge wars in terms of victories, losses, how many dead on their side, how many dead on our side, but in terms of what are we advancing? How are we making globalization extend itself? And it's not globalization at the barrel of a gun. Globalization will extend itself overwhelmingly through the private sector. It's foreign direct investment that drives this process. There are sometimes, not a big number, but at any one time there's four or five players in that gap, bad actors, bad regimes, that if they're gone, the potential for those regions, for the millions, tens of millions, sometimes hundreds of millions of people in that region, to find greater connectivity and to invite in foreign capital and have that opportunity to develop themselves, that they wouldn't have unless you remove these bad actors. I mean, the Middle East is a different, fundamentally different place because Saddam is gone. We've seen that with the elections. We've seen that with a doubling of foreign direct investment since the invasion. Now, you'd ask yourself, why would anybody invest in the Middle East in the 2 years since we started this god-awful, seemingly, process of chaos and uncertainty and violence in Iraq? Well, what it said to the global security environment, what it said to the global investing environment was the United States takes seriously stability in the Middle East. And if they take seriously stability, your chances of coming in with foreign direct investment and achieving something good are improved dramatically. That's all they need. They don't need a perfect world. They just need some sense that their investments won't be a too risky affair.
If you look at your analysis, I think you're very lucid and clear about the security dimension, about the interface between security and globalization. Where one could ask you in a way about where your analysis may not go where it should,
right.
Is with the political overlay, because what is rather interesting about the Iraq experience, in addition to the failure of combining these two forms of military in an effective way, is the failure to handle the politics as we go forward.
Right.
What are your thoughts about that? I mean, is it the case, you seem to be saying that the security will speak for itself, globalization will speak for itself, but do they translate into the politics?
That's a challenge. I mean, the first book was really all about explaining the security. The second book, as I've written it, I've discovered, is about extending the argument into the economics. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, subsequent books will get into the politics of it. But I see it in that layering sort of effect. Mm-hmm. And I'm, you know, very much from my sort of Marxian roots, I believe that economics determines politics, that good markets demand and create and engender good political systems. So good markets, good governments. But to get a good market, I have learned through the course of my career, the prerequisite is you got to have baseline security. Mm-hmm. Unless you can have credit and trust and the notion that you can sink investments that may take decades to amortize and reap benefits, you don't have markets. And if you don't have markets, you're unlikely to get a middle class, you're unlikely to get democracy. So I see it as a sequencing and a layering. This is an effort to build that entire package. The failure or the limitation of the book is that it starts the argument from the Pentagon and goes outward. Mm-hmm. But it's my belief that if you get the military right on this subject and get the U.S. military right on this subject, you have a chance to really turn history, because there is nobody who can make that kind of effort like the United States. Once it starts, it overwhelmingly becomes a private sector affair. It's driven by economics, and that's where everybody gets involved, even as much or more so as us. The Japanese with all their stuff, the Chinese, the Indians, the Russians with their energy, the Europeans with everything they bring to the table, the Brazilians as an agricultural superpower. I mean, there it gets so much bigger than us, but we are a linchpin because of this accident or just the course of history that leaves us at the end of the Cold War as the last standing military superpower in a country rich enough to be able to expend that sort of effort, and I would argue kind enough and generous enough and idealistic enough to make that effort on behalf of others. We haven't fought a war really on behalf of ourselves since the Second World War. We've been fighting wars on behalf of others and ideas and visions of a better tomorrow, which I think represents us very faithfully as a very optimistic, generous, and kind society.
Do you think that globalization will discipline us to get our house in order, in order to be able to do this? Because implicit in what you're suggesting for our role is responsibility, accountability, and so on. And the debt that we're running up suggests that we're going to be more dependent on others, including the Chinese.
There's a transaction there. Mm-hmm. I mean, what I think we've learned in terms of why we haven't seen a great power rise up since the end of the Cold War is that, in effect, they've outsourced the function to us. They've made us the Leviathan, they the rest of the world, by buying our debt, which is driven to a certain extent, but not nearly enough, by the defense budget. There's a lot of personal and private spendthriftiness in that as well, mm-hmm. in terms of the way we've racked up a lot of private sector debt. But there is a natural transaction there. They are concentrating in the rest of the world, especially in developing Asia, on economics, and they're allowing us to be the big security player in the system. So they're buying our debt and paying for that provision of security. Now, the discipline they offer to us is twofold. One, they can discipline us in terms of our spendful ways by forcing the decline of our dollar over time, by creating other reserve currencies like the euro. And ultimately, we're going to see one based in Asia on a convertible yuan and a yen in Japan. It's natural. It's got to happen. So they'll discipline us economically, but even more so important, I would argue, is they'll discipline us militarily and politically, because they can make clear to us in many ways that if they don't see a future worth creating in the employment of our military power abroad, if we don't contextualize it sufficiently within some larger vision of a better world and bring them along in the process and make clear what our goals are and our rule sets and bring them into the enunciation of the rule sets and that entire process, then they can stop buying our debt and on that basis make it economically difficult for us to maintain that force and field it. And that is, I think that's a great thing. I mean, that's what keeps us from going over the edge and becoming what a lot of overwrought and slightly hyperbolic foreign policy experts have dubbed the American Empire, mm-hmm. which I think is nonsense. Globalization comes with rules, not a ruler.
Mm-hmm. looking now at your career, your intellectual odyssey, one gets the sense, if I may say so, that you started with a concern with rule sets, and that's where you ended up in a way when you were talking about your early background. That's just an observation.
Well, a strict Catholic upbringing in the Catholic Church in general certainly engenders a certain focus on rules.
Yeah.
You know, no fish or no meat on Friday and Mass every Sunday.
But you also said you were defending the rules in the playground, I think, that I heard you say. But maybe
Yeah. I had ultimately two parents who were lawyers. I come from a family, long line of lawyers. So kind of enforcing the rules and making for a fair playing field and kind of giving everybody equal opportunity. The law defines America. And lawyers, as much as we dislike them in many ways, are a tremendous instrument of why this is such a great place to live. And I argue in the book that globalization in its current form is very much built on the American source code, mm-hmm. that it really comes out of the experience that America finally achieved after the Civil War. We finally decided we were going to be a united country and it was going to be a free country. When we married that up with the Second Industrial Revolution and you saw that kind of tremendous development and growth, it was like watching a China today. I mean, we were just bursting on the scene. And when the previous European colonial version of globalization collapsed, we were the last man standing. Mm-hmm. We have built that up not just in the United States. We built that up in what we called a West during the Cold War. And now we've expanded it to include an East increasingly. And that's our gift to history. But it's a gift. Like any gift, if it's of value, it's worth defending. And that's the role the military plays.
One final question requiring a brief answer. How would you recommend that students prepare for this future you're describing?
I would always advocate learning a second language. If you want to get serious in terms of doing strategic work or working with the military, I would always advocate getting a PhD just because it teaches you the research.
On that note, we want to thank you, Dr. Barnett, for being here today and coming to the campus as the 2005 Nimitz Lecturer. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this and other UCTV programs, visit us online at www.uctv.tv.